a Manitoba emergency alert. A flash flood alert is issued by the town of Swan River. A mandatory evacuation has been issued for parts of Swan River. Check Swan River website for areas under mandatory evacuation. Extreme rainfall has caused rapid water level rise. Floodwaters move swiftly, posing serious risks to life and property. All people must evacuate by 3 p.m. today. Bring essential documents, medications, pets, and emergency supplies. Prepare to be away from home for at least 72 hours. Individuals should evacuate to the Veterans Hall at 119 6th Avenue North to register. Follow local authority directions and check www.swanrivermanitoba.com for more information and areas under mandatory evacuation.
Once the computer has been told what shape it desired and how they look from various angles, the designer programs in the movements to be animated. To solidify it, the designer literally imitates the effect of light hitting a three-dimensional object as it moves around within the scene. The necessary oscillations are far too complex to be carried out in detail.
And then we're taking them both deeper into the economy so more people, companies, and places can participate. And so what I'm not thinking about is, because this boost keeps moving up in steps, what's the next step, maybe? So from flat to fast to deep, I think the next step is psychic. I now know your whole psychograph from your phone. I will just push you your groceries, push you the supplies you need, push you the information. And I think I could already see, the one after that. And it would be called genomic. That I now have a watch, or I have smart clothes on me, that I can actually read your human genome. So I can tell you what health you, what drugs you need to buy, what supplies you need to buy, that my neurons will connect with your genome, basically.
So are you saying then, Tom, that the next waves, that sounds to me, the psychic sounds to me like AI.
Exactly.
And Siri and all the rest of it, all these different technologies. And the genomic sounds like it's just the synthetic biology, biological revolution that we're going through.
That gets then built into our clothes, our watch, and then linked up with Walmart. So you go, Walmart tells you, we know, given your genome, these are the foods you should buy, and these are the health aids you need. And I think that's roughly where we've gone, from flat to fast to deep to psychic to genomics.
But let's tell the psychic or the AI portion. One of the things that's quite striking, so we've been doing a lot of research just on the impact of AI. And what's striking about that is that, on the one hand, I think, you know, clearly, you know, businesses, individuals will benefit from the psychic, and these technologies can deliver us and help us do things that we wouldn't do ourselves. We wouldn't even know how to do ourselves. It also seems as if the economy itself would benefit, because in the sense that, you know, as companies become more productive, as the economy becomes more productive, it actually helps the economy, it doesn't matter the economic growth. I think the big question for many people comes down to, how do we think about the ethics of these technologies and, you know, the mis and misuse concerns about those kind of psychic or AI technologies? And of course, the issue of work, but I'm sure we'll come back to the question of work. But how do you think about...
So start with the ethics question,
the ethics,
which I think is hugely important. So I actually just wrote a column the other day about how the College Board had sat down. These are the College Board, the people who administer the SAT exams. It really has a big impact on what people study in high school. And they sat down and did a sort of a radical thought experiment with themselves that, of course, it's good that kids know everything, science and math and humanities and art, of course. But if they had to choose two things that they thought every kid had to be, had to have the tools for, what would they be? And they came up with two codes. You need to master two codes. One, the ability to code a computer, or at least understand how a computer works. And the second is the U.S. Constitution.
That's interesting.
And when you think about it, James, the two actually go together. It goes back to your privacy question.
Sometimes afraid in the future. If you talk about what life will be like 10, 20 years from now, it may sound frightening, and some people imagine destructive, dystopian scenarios. But in fact, technology has been the only thing that's enabled us to overcome problems. When I was 5, I decided I'd be better. I had this idea that if you put things together in just the right way, you create transcendent effects. Other kids were wondering what they were going to be, fireman, teacher, and I always had this conceit, well, I know what I'm going to be. I started my first company when I was 18 years old. Since then, I've started quite a few others, over a dozen, I'd say.
Well, in the old days, he'd come to me with some crazy idea and then tell me, yeah, right. I don't have that reaction anymore because he's done so many things that I thought were possible.
Most inventors fail, not because they don't get their gadgets to work, but because their timing is wrong. People don't start a project when the hardware and the technological capability doesn't exist to support it. But in fact, you should do that. And realizing that, I became an art student of technology terms. And this really started about 30 years ago. Being an engineer, I gathered a lot of data. And I began to see that if it was an information technology, that it followed exquisitely predictable trajectories, and you can use this then as a planning tool that can now take projections for not just 2, 3, 4, 6 years, but 10 years, 20 years from now, and invent with the technologies of 2020, 2030. And I can't build those devices yet, but I can describe them and I can write about them, and that's been the source of the material for my book. I wrote the book The Singularity is Near, which really tried to provide a scientific foundation for this concept, to really look at the different technologies that are feeding into the profound changes that we're seeing. I do have a certain perspective on the future. does come from scientific investigation, but it does result in a different perspective of what's important today and what the future will be like. And I see the common wisdom being quite different than that. And I think it's actually important that people understand what's important. In fact, I have an opportunity to talk to an audience for an hour. I'll make a fair amount of progress in terms of convincing them that there's another way to view some of these issues.
He has a certain vision of what's going to be happening, and he would like the world to know about it, to prepare for it. He's got a mission of telling the world about what's going to come in terms of technology.
I'm really looking forward to this because the gaming industry really fits in well with what I like to talk about, which is the acceleration of progress. I've been studying for 30 years the phenomenon of the exponential growth of information technology. This has taken on a life of its own. I have a group now of 10 people that helps me gather data in many different fields, and we make mathematical models of how technology evolves. When I came to MIT, I mean, I went there in 1965, and I went there because MIT was so advanced in 1965 that it actually had its own computer. It took up half a building, cost $11 million, it was shared by thousands of students and professors who needed influence to get close to it. The computer in your cell phone today is a million times smaller, a million times cheaper, a thousand times more powerful. Evolution then shifted from biological evolution to technological evolution. Tens of thousands of years to evolve stone tools, fire, the wheel. And then we always use the latest technology to create the next technology. So the whole pace of technology has accelerated. Major paradigm shifts like search engines evolved in just 5 or 6 years. The reason we get to a singularity, a point of astonishingly quick change, is because it's going to go into very fast gear over the next several decades.
For me, Ray's projections are obvious. I mean, we are a young star and a young planet and a very young species in this 15-billion-year-old galaxy. People think of the human race as being this technologically advanced species. For God's sakes, we've been technologically advanced for a whole 100 years. We've been the human race for 100,000 years. We are just at the very beginning. We have so much to go. So much to learn. We know nothing.
Right after college, we had a meeting. We kind of got together at a pancake house in Cambridge. And he kind of laid out his goals at that point. And those goals were to invent things so that the blind could see and the deaf could hear and the lame could walk.
The reading problems of the blind may soon be significantly reduced.
For the blind student, there are never enough textbooks and research papers in Braille or recorded material.
Today, Mike Taibbi visited a Cambridge research lab where they've invented a machine that can make any book talk.
470 years ago,
the user can take an active role in his reading. He can back up, hear a line over again. He can go word by word. He can have words spelled out.
It actually started in 75 when there was this thing on the news about this man. Had come up with a way that would enable a blind person to be able to read. I said, this is crazy. This is impossible. I got to meet this person. Obviously, it was a life changer for me. It was really, really kind of big, you know. But however big it was, it didn't matter because, listen, for the first time, a blind person would be able to read his or her private information. It was an amazing experience.
The current cost of $10,000 to $20,000 makes the machine practical only for libraries, institutions, or rehabilitation centers.
The reader was very expensive back then. It had to be because the development effort was very expensive. So roughly 10 years ago, the Kurzweil reading
technology began to become very prominent as an individual consumer device.
See, it's very small.
So this device actually is kind of bulky in your pocket, but this was our first model of a portable reading machine for the blind. And a blind person just snaps a picture and it reads it out loud. So cell phones are becoming more powerful, and we expect very soon that there will be a cell phone powerful enough to actually do this whole technology in a cell phone.
I think we may see a time when having sight or not having sight doesn't really matter. You know, Ray has taught us that we'll communicate by sending thoughts to one another over the internet, that computers will be embedded in our bloodstream. Everything Ray has predicted has come true, and I have no doubt that this will too.
And so this is inevitable. It's built into our system. It can reach some limited break. I hope that doesn't happen. We're trying to engineer the development that may be emerging with our machines. But temporarily, the situation we're in right now, that the exponential growth is what's really driving it, and that I think is unstoppable. That this is going to lead to a new phase of human existence in the following sense, that we're pretty adaptable as a conscious species. So things come along, they are disruptive, we adapt to them. So back to the Industrial Revolution was somewhat disruptive, but I also think it was just one point on this exponential curve. I don't think there was anything very special about the Industrial Revolution. But then along comes modern physics and nuclear weapons and computers and iPhones and the internet, and you know, faster and faster and faster as it grows. But at some point, my concern is, because of the exponential growth, it will happen so fast that individuals and society can't adapt fast enough. I think we're pretty close to that already. Although there's a lot of conversation about regulations and how do we control this, our conversation, my book, your podcast, all part of addressing that. I think we're gonna get to the point where it's just happening faster than we can cope. And that is, I don't know what to do about that except to think about it, apply some critical thinking. But that is one of my principal concerns. And it doesn't require the AI becoming conscious. It's forcing things to happen fast enough, it's going to be a very disruptive force.
So maybe talk a little bit about what this means, and so we'll take it out of telecommunications and put it in healthcare for a second. What does this mean to health research?
Well, healthcare is very interesting. For example, Moderna tried to determine a COVID vaccine. There was a great deal of urgency in this. There was actually billions of molecular sequences that could create a COVID vaccine, and we didn't know which one was which. We actually tried them all with biological simulation. So we had the computer simulate all several billion, and we did that in 2 days. So the Moderna vaccine was actually created in 2 days. Then it took us 10 months to test it on humans. Eventually that'll be done by computer as well.
Because it's not gonna have that data being fed to it, because there's so many restrictions on the flow of data on Web 2. And even if it does have a decent amount of that data being fed to it, because they figure it out in some way, shape, form, fashion, there's no way to verify whether that data is authentic. All right, now, let's talk about fusion. The same way that ICP fuses different layer one blockchains together, it's going to fuse artificial intelligence together as well, creating an overarching form of superintelligence. So in this context, fusion, the process or result of joining two or more things together to form a single entity, all right? So if you think about Web 2, it's a system that was built on theft and exploitation, no verifiability, no security. And if you look at AGI and superintelligence in a silo or in an isolated environment, what I mean by that is like one of these big tech companies, let's say Google is probably the best one to use there. Maybe they create this form of superintelligence because they have so much data, but it only really exists in a silo, in a controlled environment, in a sandboxed environment. They can't do a whole lot with it as it relates to deploying it with all of their users and deploying it with all of their different clients that they have as far as institutions. And so they might be able to create it, but deploying it is really the challenge. Because, back to the earlier points, you have all of these different issues when it comes to deploying things at scale. Global intelligence or data is fragmented on so many different levels. Like, this doesn't even scratch the surface of how fragmented and how complex web architecture is across the board. And so just think of global intelligence like a pie graph. And there's all these little different, you know, parts of the pie graph that represent different data silos owned and controlled by different centralized companies that are behind different firewalls, that are managed by companies that make decisions differently than the other companies. They all have their own board. They all have their own governance process, right? And that creates a lot of friction when it comes to sharing data and the flow of data system to system, which is terrible for artificial intelligence. You need the most free flow of data imaginable. Two problems to solve. You need the most free flow of data imaginable while solving for data ownership down to the individual level and solving for data verifiability and security. And ICP does it all. Web2 can't do any of it. Period. And there's no quick solution to lay over top of this that's going to fix this. So companies have to. This is another big issue. This is why the incentive structure does not optimize for artificial intelligence on Web2. Companies have to try to protect their intellectual property, their data. So that's why there's so much friction when it comes to data from system to system, is because they have to go overboard to protect all of their intellectual property, to protect their data. This leads to tons of guardrails and security measures that further constrain the flow of intelligence or data. And so if you think about 100 different governance systems with different consensus mechanisms, speaking different languages, all intertwined and interdependent, the problem with being interdependent on each other is things like the CrowdStrike example. So many different companies, so many different systems use CrowdStrike that when one faulty upgrade gets pushed, it almost takes down the half of the web. Yeah, because that's how fragile and how interdependent the entire web framework is. And so many are competitors. Many of these big tech companies are competitors. Some of them are not. And the incentive model sometimes encourages collaboration, but oftentimes it doesn't. But even when companies collaborate, and I'm very familiar with this process just from my old job, even when these tech companies collaborate with each other and form partnerships and form these pre-built integrations to make things more seamless for the end user, even when that happens, combining these systems in a seamless, verifiable, secure way is impossible on Web2. You can do it a little bit better than the competitors and have a little bit better user experience and more free flow of data than the other providers. But at the end of the day, doing this in a way that is seamless, verifiable, and secure is impossible. Fragmentation at every level, corporate, government, individual, every single level, there's fragmentation of data and or intelligence. So, and just think about Web2. Let's just look at the framework and the principles and every, like, how Web2 has played out based on how it was set up initially. The best and the brightest do not rise to the top on Web2. If anything, they are likely suppressed. Think about how much bad data, just because they incentivize on social media shitposting and degeneracy and outrage type posts. They incentivize some of the worst types of posts, and those get the most engagement on social media. Well, all of that data is being fed to artificial intelligence, right? So because the incentive-based models on the web and for tech companies specifically are so jacked up, it almost leads to them creating their own problem with there being tons of bad data on their platform that later gets ingested by their artificial intelligence because they've incentivized their users to post garbage and create tons of bad data. Yeah. So if anything, so the best and the brightest do not rise to the top on Web2. If anything, they are likely suppressed. And that's what I'm talking about, the diffusion of intelligence all around the world.
but we're going to be able to do things in a way that's much more expeditious than it's been done before. Previously, we tried to find somebody who had some experience with the thing that you're trying to cure, and we would actually test it out on humans. It would take months or years, and we would then find out certain things that we had to redo. Typically, a new medication takes about 10 years, costs several $1 billion. We can now actually do it in a matter of days by actually simulating biology in a computer using AI. So, and we're seeing that come to fruition already.
So we talked a little bit about some of the good uses. We've got a cyber audience here. Let's talk about some of the malicious uses of this. What does this technology mean relative to cybersecurity? And sort of as you forecast out how people are going to use this and how the good guys and the bad guys are going to be battling each other, how do you think about that?
Well, we're counting on all of you, anybody involved with secure connections. For example, we're going to be able to put things in our brain that will communicate outside, and we'll go to a nearby cloud. Right now we can amplify our intelligence using this. So I can actually find out anything that human beings have ever found. But it takes me like a minute or two to actually access this. It's not very convenient. It'd be good if it actually was in our mind. If things would occur to us as quickly as our thoughts occur to us, that will happen in the 2030s. But it's very important that we keep that confidential. So secure connections is very important. But I think we actually know a lot about how to do that. We're able to keep the things quiet. But that's a very important issue. So what you're doing is actually very key to the future of being able to keep these things safe.
Well, let's build on that a little bit. You mentioned the 2030. Hopefully people caught what he just said, right? So I'm guessing you're jumping into nanobots and its relationship to, you know, human beings and how that ultimately can, this is a overly simplistic term, but sort of turn us all into integrated circuits in some way. You said in the 2030s, that's not very far away. You're talking maximum 15 years, you know, near term,
right.
6 years.
I'm saying we'll have AGI, a computer that can do anything that a human can do better than any human being. So, I can play Go, but I don't play a very good game of it. But computers can play Go better than any human. And they'll be able to do everything that humans can do, only better. But people look at this as us versus the computer, whether the computer is smarter than us. But actually, we're going to bring it into ourselves. We're going to become smarter. So all the capability that a computer have, we're going to have. Now, we already have a lot of capability just using this thing. This didn't exist 10 years ago. Maybe a minute or so, I can actually access any intelligence that human beings have. But we'll be able to do this instantly in the 2030s.
So, are we ready for this? Talk about the human side.
I think we're more than ready.
Why that too needs understanding them. And understanding them requires to be conscious of them. Now that's required. The point I was making is that consciousness enables you to transcend the rules. You see why they're true, and that goes you beyond it. You see, what the Gödel theorem does, it tells you how to use your understanding of why the rules are true to transcend the rules. You think that AI is the simple tool or simple thing that we can use in the single case?
No, not so single. It's obviously infinite. No, clearly, that's not the point. The point is it doesn't know what it's doing. That's still true with AI. You talk to an AI thing, it doesn't know what it's doing. It speaks from experiences, if you like. You see, people have confused the story. The story is they've lost it in the power of computing. The thing is that computers have got so powerful that they've lost the thread of what they're doing. I think the point has got lost. I think Turing wasn't too far off. You see, he was a little bit confused person in a way, because it was not clear what he believed. But he did call this thing the Turing test. How do you decide whether an entity is conscious or not? Will you have a conversation with it? You talk to it.
Maybe AI is a new sphere of human existence.
No. It's missing something.
Emergency alert. A flash flood alert is issued by the town of Swan River. A mandatory evacuation has been issued for parts of Swan River. Check Swan River website for areas under mandatory evacuation. Extreme rainfall has caused rapid water level rise. Floodwaters move swiftly, posing serious risks to life and property. All people must evacuate by 3 p.m. today. Bring essential documents, medications, pets, and emergency supplies. Prepare to be away from home for at least 72 hours. Individuals should evacuate to the Veterans Hall at 119 6th Avenue North to register. Follow local authority directions and check www.swanrivermanitoba.com for more information and areas under mandatory evacuation.
Well, you have to be careful. First of all, the name is wrong. It's not artificial intelligence. It's not intelligence. Intelligence would involve consciousness. And I've always been a strong promoter of the idea that these devices are not conscious, and they will not be conscious unless they bring in some other ideas. They're all computable notions. I think when people use the word intelligence, they mean something which is conscious. I mean that. You see, I developed my own ideas after going to a course. You see, when I was a graduate student in Cambridge, I went to three courses which were nothing to do with what I was supposed to be doing. One was by Bondi on general relativity. One was by Dirac on quantum mechanics.
So the deeper computing goes into us, and the ethical and privacy questions that will raise, the more you want people imbued with knowledge of the Constitution and the five freedoms, and it isn't just freedom of speech, it's the freedom of assembly and petition, all these other things.
So how do we combine those two things? Clearly there's a need to understand how the system of these machines work, and then also these, call them civics or societal-based principles. How do we bring those two things to work? The reason I bring that up is partly because even on the computer science part of it, one of the challenges with these concerns about fairness and bias and so forth, yes, about the use of these technologies,
yeah,
comes down to the fact that technically it's actually quite hard to code for fairness. Technically, it's actually quite hard to get at things like explainability. So why do the algorithm decide to do that versus that? Why that prediction versus this? What in the data set or the feature set led to that? Those are actually very hard computer science questions. And, you know, there's work going on in that. But so we've got that challenge. Then we've got the challenge you're posing, which is how do we combine that with civics, philosophy, ethics? What would you say? I mean, how would you do that?
Well, I we're really talking about two boxes. One is a work box, and one is an ethics values box. So let's try to disaggregate them for a second. I think the work challenge I described this way. What was basically happened as a result of the no ordinary disruptions we've been through, is that the foundation of the American middle class has completely shrunk almost to zero. What was the foundation of the American middle class? By the way, the European middle class and the Asian middle class. there was something called a high-wage, middle-skill job.
Yes.
High wages, but middle-skill. So my uncle, in the early 1960s, was the loan officer at the Farmers and Mechanics Bank in Minneapolis, and he only had a high school degree. Is there any loan officer at any bank anywhere, okay, that only has a high school degree? No. So he had a high-wage, middle skills, but he actually had a high-wage job. Well, that actually was the foundation of the middle class. And everything we need to be thinking about today, I believe, if you're running for president, is how you return the high-wage. It doesn't have to be middle skill, but it's going to actually be higher skill just by the nature of things. Because basically what happens when the high-wage middle-skill job disappeared, we now have high-wage high-skill jobs. We have low-wage low-skill jobs. As your research has shown, those are growing, actually.
Right.
But how do we get more people into the high-wage high-skill, you know, band of jobs? That, I think, is the central economic and political question for society if you want a stable middle class.
No, I couldn't agree more. And in fact, in some ways, we're already there. That problem really exists, right? Because think about the conversations the last five or so years about income inequality. Some of the work we've done highlights, of course income inequality is there. It's actually gotten worse. But the really striking thing is the wage stagnation that we've seen.
For decades.
And in fact, in some ways, arguably, it could be at the root of some of the angst and concerns that society has. And then you layer on top of that the trends we're talking about, the impact of technology and so forth, and you can just, if you project it forward, so one of the things that we don't worry about, and it's not as much on this technology jobs question, is this issue about will there be enough jobs? I think, all the scenarios and all the work we've done and other economists have done suggest there will be enough jobs, at least in the next couple of decades. Now, of course, you should always worry about that because things could change and so forth. But what will absolutely be real challenges are probably a few key things. One is this question about how occupations are going to shift, because we know that as technology starts to automate some work and some activities, some occupations are going to decline. But others are going to rise. And, to your example about, just what's happened to the middle class, many of the occupations that have been declining have had middle wage incomes at middle wage skills, and those are going to decline. The ones that are growing, that will grow, don't look like there will be high income earning jobs. So as that plays out between the jobs lost and the jobs gained, even though there'll be enough work, then you worry about three big transitions, and I'm going to test these on you to see what you think, whether we're ready to deal with this. One is how we deal with the occupational shifts. People moving from one occupation to another, often one place to another. That's a big challenge. The scale of that is quite substantial. The second question are the what you might call skill shifts. In some cases, the skill needs are going to be much higher. In some cases, they're just different. So how do we, how do people navigate the skill shift, which is quite substantial? And then the third one is what you're alluding to, which is the income wage question, which is, will people be able to earn enough? And those are pretty big challenges, even in a world where there's enough work.
So back in the 50s, I was born in 1953, when people were running for office, back in Minnesota, there were a lot of one-word answers: raise taxes, lower taxes. More Social Security, more Medicare, whatever.
Grow the economy.
Exactly. I think that what's different about this moment, James, is if you're running for office and your mom's a politician, actually, there are 100 different answers. It's not going to be just one simple fix, okay? And what's also scary is they change every year. All right. And so the old days, we need to sort of rely on, I'm a Democrat, that's what this means. You know, so let's go down the list. Well, what you described, the world you described, there's one thing we know for sure, that your health care, your pension, and your learning, which has to be the newest entitlement program, basically, the ability to be a lifelong learner, all three of those have to become ubiquitous and mobile. So that if I'm running for office, I start there. That's how do I make your pension, your health care affordable, and you're learning mobile and easily accessible for your life. I think those are the three central questions for lifting people back into the middle class. That's a broad economic answer. That's at the national level. At the local level, I think there's a community answer. And that's how communities come together and build what I call complex adaptive coalitions, where business, labor, philanthropists, educators, social entrepreneurs, and local government all network together to build a coalition to entice the companies, to inspire startups, to create those jobs. Today, you need 3 people starting jobs for 7. You need 8 people starting jobs for 30. You need 2 starting jobs, for 20. That's where we're gonna get those 25,000 jobs. So if I were running for office, I'd be running as a startup Democrat. You know, we basically, we're seeing the cleavage in the Democratic Party. The world has changed, and more is on you. And that means 2 things. One is, you have to be a lifelong learner. If you want to be a lifelong employee at the New York Times or McKinsey, you've got to be a lifelong learner. My friend Heather McGowan always likes to say, Mom, Dad, never ask your kids what you want to be when you grow up, because we're
The way the robot forms bond is that humans are wired to bonding. We create connections with inanimate objects all the time. I mean, with a robot that has eyes, can make eye contact, can smile back at you, and can speak to you and express emotion and empathy, it's actually not that hard to create a bond there. And children open up to these robots very quickly in ways that they may not even open up to their therapists or parents.
Thank you, Paolo. Regina, you not only made an impact on oncology, your team at MIT used AI to discover what could be our first new antibiotic in 3 decades. It seems it can beat E. coli, MRSA, and strains of bacteria which are currently resistant to all other antibiotics. So I think we all wish it success. How did you do that?
So I should say that even though developing antibiotics is not an area with an immense competition, even though the resistance to antibiotics that we have continues to grow, this happened to be an area where pharmaceutical companies are not very active because economically it doesn't work for them. So in some ways we do need to have alternative approaches. I met a colleague and he was from biological engineering, he was working on antibiotics, and he was describing the big problem of finding new molecules which are effective against bacteria, drug-resistant bacteria, but at the same time are not toxic to humans. So he had some molecules screened against I think E. coli. We started with that, and then we just gave to the machine, thousands of molecules, and for each molecule you knew whether it kills a bacteria or not. And it was kind of the first attempt to learn automatically how do you look at the structure of the molecule and predict whether it would have a desired effect. We found molecule that didn't look like something human created, and it turns out in the lab that it was able to kill using a different mechanism of action, kill it in a different way, and that's what made it so effective against so many different species.
David, let's go back to you. So far, we've been talking about systems designed to perform one task. That's known as narrow AI. But you're working towards artificial general intelligence. Could you explain what artificial general intelligence is?
So if you think about humans and human intelligence, it's this wonderful and beautiful thing where we're able to learn skills which are incredibly diverse, where one person might choose to specialize in learning how to play tennis, and another person might specialize in becoming an amazing chef, and another person a pianist, and another person a scientist. And so when we want to build artificial intelligence, we want systems which not only solve a single problem, but in a similar manner to humans, are able to approach any number of problems with intelligence that's capable of doing amazing things in each of those different areas. And that's what we refer to as artificial general intelligence, or AGI for short.
And how far off do you think we are from that being a reality?
So I think it's going to be a spectrum over many years. And I also think it's likely, or at least plausible, that there are many breakthroughs that are still required before we can really crack the same kind of level of intelligence that humans have.
Regina, you've developed AI to better predict cancer, but it's only employed in a tiny number of cases, right? Why is it Why is AI not used more widely in medicine?
The problem is that we're creating a lot of great technology, but this technology is not really translated into patient care. And if I would ask the audience, you know, how many of you, when you last time see your physician, you actually have seen any AI? And I'm sure not many can really attest to it. So I think the technology for many of the tasks is really mature, but there are many other questions which have nothing to do with AI per se. One is the regulation. Regulations both in Europe, UK, US continue to change. Another big problem is people don't really know how to bill for AI. And today the American doctor who uses AI loses money when they see the patient, so it's not much of the motivation.
So just to clarify there, did you say that using AI for doctors in the US can actually make them lose money because it makes treatment more effective and
I'm referring to a specific paper. The billing is done, it somehow relates to the time the doctor spends with the patient. So if you have something that makes it faster, you're actually losing money.
Very depressing. Paolo, what about your challenges? The robot you've developed mimics human behavior. What's next?
I'm very hopeful with what we are doing in terms of creating social, emotional AI systems that can help humanity become its best. If we can intervene early with children, for instance, on autism spectrum, they have a chance of really integrating well with the society and do really well. When we think about other vulnerable areas of our life is when we age, social isolation, being lonely, and that leads to mental health issues, that leads to physical health issues, and so on. We can have the same systems become a companion that help you there. Once we figure out the physical task, you can also imagine that they can give you assistive care, meaning that they can be not only be a social emotional companion for you, but they can also be a companion saying, let's cook some food together, let's go for a walk together, and so on, which is going to help a lot with independent living with dignity when we are at that age.
Do you think we'll see robots helping with assistive care in the future anytime soon, or is this way off in the distance?
I think it is within the next decade.
Oh, wow. David, you're working on Gemini, which is Google's answer to ChatGPT, and you aim for it to be able to do both tax returns and write a novel. People would probably be very happy to have their tax returns done, or I would definitely would be. But novels, should we really be letting AI sort of take over human culture?
So it's a great question. I think I wouldn't see it as taking over human culture. I think what will happen, or the most likely outcome, is that we'll be providing an incredibly powerful tool to human authors. So we've already seen this in a number of areas where we've developed technologies that enable authors of different kinds of media to basically create things much more powerfully using tools. So for example, there's a music authoring system called Lyria that was released recently. And there's this wonderful footage of, you know, Will.i.am when he's playing with it for the first time. And he's just so excited because he says it can kind of speed up his songwriting process by, you know, 10 or 100 times. So I think, you know, what I really hope we get to is a world in which the AI and the humans kind of work together to just make everything better. So, you know.
It's more than two computers. It's more than to compute. technology. The thinkers and poets of the past pulled away.